So we've been going through this series in Acts for about 18 months now, and we've kind of doing a few chapters and then going away and coming back. And now we are reaching chapters 13, 14, and 15. I'm on chapter 14 today. As I explained last week, I'm not really planning to do like a really in-depth, close textual study, close exegesis and all that good stuff. That's great. You can do that. If you want to get deeper into the text, very happy to recommend some good commentaries, you know, different levels, very accessible and all sorts. That's great. Really what I'm using the text for in this little mini-series is just to somehow use it as a launch pad to help empower and restory and reimagine our mission. So this is called Begin. So these chapters deal with what's called Paul's first missionary journey, the first journey that St. Paul took to share the gospel in the Near East there. But I think that's a fantastic opportunity for us to kind of look at our missionary journey, whatever that looks like, and what it looks like today, and almost to get back to sort of first principles, to brass tacks, and kind of see where we might find ourselves in terms of finding new imagination, new stories, new energy, and new power to share this amazing good news. So, without further ado, I'm going to dive into the text. The message today is called The Gods Amongst Us, for reasons which I hope will soon become clear. Acts 14, you can follow along in your Bibles or your app. Make sure I didn't make this up. Or you can read it off the screen. Now remember, what's been happening is that Paul and Barnabas have set off on this journey, and the pattern that they've kind of adopted is they go to a new town, and they're Jewish men, and this movement, this Jesus movement, has grown up as pretty much a purely Jewish thing. So when they go to new towns, obviously they go to the synagogue and they chat to their Jewish brothers, and they share, and brothers and sisters, and they share what's been going on. But as we shared last week, this good news has started to burst out amongst the Gentile community as well, which is an exciting new departure. This is unprecedented. This is unexpected. And so Paul and Barnabas said last week, you know, and sometimes they've been meeting a lot of resistance from the Jewish community, and they've been saying, look, if you don't feel yourselves ready or worthy to receive this word, fine, then we will go to the Gentiles. And so that's what it's talking about there. The same thing occurred in Iconium, where Paul and Barnabas went into a Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and the Greeks became believers. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. And then skipping ahead, I'm not going to read the whole chapter out, but skipping ahead, they basically have to flee, they face persecution, they're in danger. And then, a bit like happened last week, there's a dramatic, miraculous event in Lystra. There's this town called Lystra. And a man who has not been able to walk all for years and years and years, he is dramatically healed. And the local people, they're like blown away. And they think that the gods have come down. And they think that that Barnabas is Zeus. And they think that Paul is Hermes. And they're thinking the gods must be amongst us. The gods must have come down from Mount Olympus and be, you know, doing wonders amongst us. And they try to make sacrifices. They run up to the local temple and they grab the priest of Zeus, and he brings some bulls down, and you know, they're about to sacrifice the bulls, and then Paul and Barnabas say, no, don't sacrifice the bulls, and the bulls go, live to bull another day. Do bulls moo? They moo another day? I don't know. Anyway, whatever bulls do, they live to do it another day, but probably not many other days. Paul and Barnabas are very distressed by this, and they say this. They say, friends, why are you doing this? We are mortals just like you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to follow their own ways, yet he has not left himself without a witness in doing good, giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons and filling you with food and your hearts with joy. And then to carry the story along, Jews from Antioch and Iconium, and that's interesting, these are the places they've already been, and they turn up in a new town, and then there's this like posse on their heels who are coming along to say, no, don't listen to these guys, we don't like these guys, they're terrible, and argue against them. It's really interesting that they are so hated that they have this posse of haters who think that it's really worth just following them around the ancient Near East to try and sort of rubbish their message. And after initially a positive reception, The people, the crowd, then turn against Paul and Barnabas, and Paul is stoned and left for dead, and they go on to another town called Derby, which is somewhere in the north of England, I believe. Midlands. It's north of Guildford, so it's north to me, as far as I'm concerned. Anywhere north of Chichester is north, as far as I'm concerned. So they go through Derby, and they make many, many disciples. There are people who are really hungry for this word. And then, interestingly, they go back. The end of the chapter is their journey back. They go back through all these places where they were persecuted, hated, stoned, left for dead, in one circumstance at least. All these places that they'd face such oppositions. And we read this from verse 22. And there they strengthened the souls of the disciples and encouraged them to continue in the faith, saying, "It is through many persecutions that we must enter the kingdom of God." And after they had appointed elders for them in each church, with prayer and fasting, they entrusted them to the Lord in whom they had come to believe. And eventually, we read in the last couple of verses that they go all the way back to Antioch, where they'd originally been commissioned, and they share and they give testimony to the church of all the stuff that's been happening. Excuse me. So, I want to start off by talking about what we might call common grace, in quotes, and religious misfires. There's actually an idea in theology called common grace. It's very big in sort of Reformed Calvinist circles. This idea that God has particular grace for salvation, but he also has common grace. There is this idea that just God's goodness just bursts out through all of creation. And we can kind of really see that in what Paul was just sharing. This idea that God has always, always lavished blessings on all people. You know, he gives the sun to shine on your crops. He causes food to grow up so that you can eat it. He gives you joy. He wants you to be joyful. Isn't that amazing? God's desire for us is joy, not hard work, not a clean record book, but joy. He wants there to be joy in our lives, in our hearts. And naturally, the way that some people will respond to that is in religious ways. Remember what I was talking about last week. Every human being has a religious impulse. No matter whether they identify as a religious person, as a person of faith, doesn't matter. We all have the same religious impulses. And like the weeds bursting out all over the place in my garden, it's going to burst out somewhere. Whatever you call it, whatever labels you give it, that religious instinct is going to burst out somewhere. And that in this instance, people want to respond in the way that their culture has taught them to respond, to see these people as Zeus and Hermes and these kind of characters. They want to make animal sacrifices to them because that's what their culture has kind of prepared them to think like. And in the same way, in our own culture, we're going to see good things. We're going to find good things all the time because I believe God's fingerprints are on all things. So if God's hand, if God's maker's mark, if God's spirit, if God's image is in all people, then we're going to find good things bursting out. We're going to find that mark of that holy fingerprint. We might find it in people's values. We might find it in people's morals or the attitudes that they hold or the causes that they fight for. We might go, wow, that's really amazing. As a Christian, ever met someone who's just a much better person than you are? All the time, every day. I'm a Christian. And the interesting thing is that often the values and the morals and the attitudes and the causes that we see so many amazing people around us espousing and living up to, those are deeply rooted in Christian identity. They are Christian values. They're not pagan values. They're Christian morals. They're Christian causes. Even though people might not actually identify as Christians, they might not even think of themselves as having a faith, and yet you can see in their attitudes and the things that kind of excite them and get them going, you can see the fingerprints of Jesus. People have this religious impulse, as I said, even though they might not identify with it, they might not recognize it as such, it's going to burst out somewhere. Hopefully not people trying to sacrifice bulls in your presence, but maybe that happens to you all the time, I don't know. In our culture, I see a coming together. Last week I shared this image with you, and It's a pebble, it's a stone resting on a frozen pond or something. And I see in our culture a kind of coming together of ideas and of ethics that resemble religion. And it's a bit like this. It's something that's very solid. It feels very solid, but it's actually resting on something very, very thin and very fragile in our culture. And I think it will really help us to understand our culture and to share the good news that we have into that culture if we try and understand what's going on a little bit better. It kind of is bundled together. Often you've probably heard of this expression, woke. And often a lot of the values I want to talk about today seem to be bundled under this expression, woke. But I'm not trying to be dismissive. I don't want to, you know, simplify something that's probably a lot more complicated any more than I have to anyway. What I do want to do is kind of tease apart some of the strands that we see in the religion of our culture, you know, in order to understand it, in order to understand what is our cultural religion. Because bear with me, as I said before, everyone has a religious impulse. Our culture is a religious culture. It just doesn't think of it as self. So what are the threads that are lying underneath that? What are our articles of faith as a culture? What are our objects of worship as a culture? And as we understand this, we can start to see how that religious impulse is bursting out. And I think that will lead us to be able to have very helpful, very fruitful conversations about where people might want to take that religious impulse. So I'm going to go through a whole bunch of words now, which I think are important. I'm going to try not to go into too much detail. A lot of the words end in ism. I don't want this to put you off. Okay? Bear with me. The first one is materialism. That is a big, big idea in our culture. Materialism simply means it's the idea that all there is in this whole universe is measurable physical phenomena. There's nothing else. Therefore, there is nothing that's immaterial. All that is just an illusion. There's nothing transcendent. There's no intelligence. There's no design. There's no will. And there's no purpose to any of it. It is all just random goo and bits and bobs. That's my science. I'm not a trained scientist, you understand? Random goo and bits and bobs. You can watch a BBC documentary if you want more physics talk. There's no purpose, there's no design, there's no will beyond what we might read into. We might well read into things, purpose and design and will, but it's a bit like, you know, seeing patterns in the clouds. You're kind of reading it onto. It's not really there. In a sense, it's just a kind of an elaborate fiction. But if you think this way, and I'm not going to give like a detailed breakdown of every one of these. We'd be here for hours and hours. But I'm just going to have a very brief illustration of maybe how fragile that ice is underneath something that seems to be almost solid and unassailable. If you think this way, then everything is random. Everything is random. The process of thinking, that means that if everything is random, then thought is random. Think about that. If everything is random, then thought is random. So the process of thinking is random, and it's all just random. Even us having this conversation is completely pointless because it's all random. Thinking about the subject of thinking is pointless because it's random. You can see how this falls apart quite quickly. Because if the process of thinking is not rooted in anything that's actually true, it's just rooted in these kind of, you know, poo, 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 meaningless emanations that have just kind of burst off my frontal cortex, and they might have gone this way and they might have gone that, then what's the value of the thought generated by them? So what's the value of being a materialist? Because you thought that you'd be a materialist and thinking is random, so that was pointless. If the truth doesn't exist, then honest inquiry is an illusion. If it's only the random firing of neurons which could have landed either way, at that point, the whole scientific enterprise collapses because there's nothing to actually find. There's no honest truth. But it doesn't. The scientific enterprise doesn't collapse. And why doesn't it? Because it's rooted in a Christian mindset. All science and all honest inquiry is rooted in the idea that there is something true worth discovering it. And pursuing it is a noble and worthwhile occupation. Noble, worthwhile. Does that sound like purpose to you? Yeah, it does a bit, doesn't it? All science and all honest inquiry is rooted in the search for the truth, that somehow, in some way, the truth will set you free. There will be some good. That sounds like an article of faith to me, doesn't it? Let's move on. To the fun and games that is nihilism. Materialism, if everything is just stuff and goo, and there's no meaning and there's no purpose, and we are basically sacks of goo waiting to decompose, then what's the point? That's the end of the sermon. Thanks very much. See you next week. No, it's not. What's the point if it's all just material, if it's all just stuff that's random, then what's the point? And you can see that kind of nihilistic. There's no meaning, there's no purpose. You see that kind of carved through our society, particularly with our young people and the media. It's a very confused way of thinking. But if you follow it logically, then the only logical outcomes are basically hedonism or self-destruction. Because when you face the tragedy of existence, if there's no point and then there's no meaning, then what are we still doing here? Or it's just, well, let's just have a really, really good time. Go nuts, mad, pleasure, joy. But then against the tragedy of life, that can start to fade, can't it? There's no amount of pleasure that will ultimately fill up that massive gap. So ultimately, nihilism just leads to self-destruction. But the funny thing, it was not that funny, to be honest, but the thing about nihilism, even though it's rooted in materiality, nihilism contradicts everything that you find in the material world. Just think about it. You know, our entire biology is wrapped around the idea of pattern and tool recognition. I was watching something the other day that says when we see something, what we actually see is whether we can grasp it. We see a tool. We go, can I pick that up? Can I touch it? Can I climb on it? We perceive the world as patterns of tools based on whether we can actually grasp them. That's the first thing that happens instantly in our brain. So everything is about shapes and patterns and recognizing their significance and making use of them. Every species that you find on the planet, every species that we can observe, our whole time is spent about creating stability and conditions in which we can prosper and then hand that on to the next generation, isn't it? And then they can go and squander it. Grr. But no, our whole biology is working around creating stability and purpose. Sounds like purpose to you? Sound like a plan? Sound like something that we should be excited by, something that should give our life meaning, stability, patterns, shapes, in other words, purpose. In fact, our whole neurochemistry rewards us for making little job lists and then ticking them off. Who loves a task list? Who loves a checkbox? Literally, you see a task, you say, I've got to do this, 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 and then I get a reward. You've created a little list in your brain, and every time you check one of them off, your brain gives you a little hit of dopamine. Ooh, ooh, that was fun. Ooh. Your brain literally rewards you with a little happiness for checking things off your task list. My wife has got a very big task list. She loves checking things off, and now I understand why. And incidentally, depending on your theology of creation, I'm not going to get into that now, this neurochemistry, this basic neurochemistry, we share with lobsters. Now, if you go that way, separated by 350 million years on the evolutionary tree, so you could say it's fairly deeply ground in this whole idea of purpose and structure and doing things. I'll move swiftly on. Because materialism also leads us to consumerism. Because if we're just material, if we're just stuff, and that's all there is out there, then of course we need material things. And in our culture, our entire being is constructed and maintained by consuming things, buying things, eating things, having things. We believe, and our society tells us, that our needs are satisfied. And even more, our identity is actually formed by having stuff. Is this a cool person? Is this a good person? Is this a desirable person? You just need to look in their shopping basket. How shallow, how nonsensical. And of course, the hole is never, ever filled because you cannot buy enough stuff, because you're not simply material. The premise is wrong. You cannot meet your human needs. You cannot flourish as a human being purely by material stuff, because you are a spiritual being. And that's why the hole is never filled. Here's another one. Significance. If you follow this line, you end up with this really weird paradox that everything is meaningless, and that means we're meaningless, and that means we're insignificant, and nothing really matters, including us. And yet, at the same time as this being the kind of the religious idea of our culture that we are completely insignificant, we are craving significance. People get unwell because they feel invisible, don't they? People are mentally unwell. They don't flourish because they don't feel seen. We crave our 15 minutes of fame. How many likes have I got on Facebook? I put something on Facebook yesterday. How many people have liked it yet? If not enough people like it, I'll just feel... What? A bunch of people, many of whom I barely know, bothered to go, like. Oh, that's a real connection. How close we are. We crave to be seen. We crave significance. We need to be known. And yet our society tells us that we're completely irrelevant and it's all pointless and it's all insignificant. And yet you just have to look at an image like that of our planet to know how incredibly significant and important everything is. I can't remember the sums exactly, but the probability of life existing on this planet is something like 1 in 10 to the 128 million power. So that's it's a 1 with 128 million zeros behind it. Not 128 million, 128 million zeros behind. That's a lot of zeros. I can't count that high. No one ever could. And yet that is how wildly improbable our existence is. And yet our popular culture, because the maths don't add up, and lots of people have said, well, these maths, it looks like someone's almost kind of working the strings and like making things happen. Well, we can't have that, can we? So you invent ideas like the multiverse. How many films are out at the moment, like the Marvel films, that include the multiverse, this idea of multiple realities, and every time you make a decision, the universe goes off on a shoot and creates another one? It's completely unscientific. There is no proof for this at all, but it kind of papers over the cracks of the maths. Oh, yeah, we believe in the multiverse. What evidence have you got? Oh, none. You silly Christians with your acts of faith. But just look at our popular culture and see what it shows us. Now I'm going to talk about postmodern ideology and all God's people said. Oh, no. But I won't talk about it for very long, don't worry. Going to wind up with this, really. The idea, very, very complicated. I spent a lot of time studying postmodernism. There are very many things about postmodernism that are very useful and helpful. But I'm talking about the ideology that comes from it, which I think is incredibly toxic. Bottom line of postmodern ideology is that there is one sort of dynamic in this world, and it's oppression. Oppressors and oppressed. That is the only dynamic that is at work in human civilization. It's basically a rebadging of Marxist ideology. It's why it's often called neo-Marxism. But rather than the Marxists, it was about, you know, the working class being oppressed by the capitalists. Now it's just a group being oppressed by another group. Okay? That's all there is in society, is oppressors and oppressed. Okay, question. In that worldview, how do you work out whether you're a good person or not? How do you assess your moral worth? Because there's only two different sorts of people, aren't there? Oppressors and oppressed. So which one am I? So if I can make sure that I'm oppressed, if I can identify with the ways that I'm oppressed, I know that I'm on the right side. I'm not one of those nasty oppressors. I'm only one of the oppressed. And so we find ever more forensic ways of finding oppression and trying to work out what we are victims of. What are we victims of? The patriarchy. That's what. Boo. I say the patriarchy, you have to go boo. Otherwise, the patriarchy. We'll work on that. I'll come back to that. all good lies are seasoned with just enough truth to be palatable, aren't they? That's how a really good lie works. And in my opinion, a lot of the confusion and even the deception today comes from that old trick of taking one thing that is true and making it the whole story. Is there oppression in this world? Of course there is. Of course there is. Is it the whole story? No, it isn't. That's far too simplistic. You take one idea and you totalize it, you absolute it, you remove any nuance or any subtlety, and in the process you throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's the first trick. The next trick is to appeal to justice. And much injustice is done under the banner of justice. Because the desire for justice is, of course, a foundational Christian idea. That's what the Hebrew word and the Greek word for righteousness means. It's the same word, righteousness, justice, same word in Greek and Hebrew. The desire for justice is absolutely central to the Christian story. And of course, it lines up, because of that, it lines up with who we are as human beings. It lines up with our moral center. So naturally, decent and moral people will want to be on the side of justice. Of course we will. So that's the second trick. I think it was George Orwell that said something like, it's Marxists, they're not driven by love for the working class, they're driven by hatred of the people in power, because that's not us. And then guess what happens when they get in power? They kill lots and lots and lots of the working class. The most egregious massacres of the 20th century probably happened in Soviet Russia and Maoist China. And you think of the killing fields, and it goes on and on and on in Cambodia. In this mindset, this fight against the patriarchy is all bad. And there's no question about that. But what we've got to remember is that patriarchy means fatherhood. So hang on a second. Fatherhood is all bad? Now, there is certainly bad fatherhood. Tyrannical, stifling, abusive, coercive. Maybe some of you have unfortunately been the victims of bad fatherhood, and there is no question about that. But, and this is where that absoluting lie comes in, there is also good fatherhood. It is loving, it's guiding, it's wise, it's nurturing, and it's absolutely essential for human flourishing. And if we throw the baby out with the bathwater, do you think you might end up with a completely broken society? Jung identified these in all sorts of stories, mythology, folklore, tales. It even comes in like Disney movies. You've got the good king and you've got the wicked tyrant, these two aspects of fatherhood. Always, fatherhood can be the wicked tyrant like Scar when he takes over, or it can be the good king like Mufasa at the beginning and Simba, isn't it, at the end. And scripture reveals to us our Father God, loving creator, who is love himself, author of life. But it also reveals another father, the father of lies, Satan. Fatherhood can go either way. Fatherhood, patriarchy, is not always just the evil tyrant. It can also be the good, wise king. And fatherhood, masculinity in general, you might say, is not just about violence and oppression and domination. It can and it should be about wise structure and protection and strength and courage. You know, you've got, as a side note, you've got a whole generation of boys who don't know how to be men because all they've ever heard is that masculinity is something bad to be ashamed of. We've got this expression, toxic masculinity. But I wonder whether how people mean it sometimes. Do they mean toxic masculinity as opposed to good masculinity and you want to, you know, not have this and have that? Or do they mean toxic masculinity as, in other words, all masculinity is toxic? Again, how are boys supposed to learn how to be good men and good father if their very maleness is something they're meant to be ashamed of? Do we end up with a broken society? I wonder. We need to be really aware of this. I'm coming into land now, so if the band can come back, we'll end with a final song. An attack on fatherhood in absolute terms, with no differentiation between the good and the bad, is a catastrophe for our society. We can see it in a spiraling epidemic of poor mental health, of political corruption, you know, of behavior and dereliction and immorality on a breathtaking scale. Where are our good fathers? We can see it in crises of identity and purpose and significance and spiritual well-being. And this is built in large part upon some of the ideas I've been unpacking today, and there are plenty more. I might come back to them next week. And they can seem so ubiquitous and so all-pervading, and they're everywhere, and they're in the universities, and they're in the media, and it's just unchallengeable sometimes, or so it seems. It might seem like it's the way things are. It might seem like it's the water we swim in. But actually, when you start to tease and you start to pull apart, you see that some of these ideas are actually open to question. They might be full of holes. In many cases, they're just not true. But the religion of our time is powerful and it is intimidating, maybe. I've really thought about what I say today and what I say over this series. I don't want to be cancelled. It can be intimidating. And we need to be really careful that we don't just hide being like, you know, reactionary and obnoxious under, oh, that's what the gospel is. It's not. We have to just be a lot more subtle, a lot more careful about reading the signs. But if there's one encouragement to take from the text that we had today, it's about the fact that the believers were strengthened through persecutions and trials. And even in very new believers, Paul and Barnabas saw enough faith to raise them up to be elders and leaders in those congregations. Bearing in mind, they'd only been through like a couple of months before. And these people were tuned into God and they were listening to the Holy Spirit and they were loving Jesus enough that they were able to lead their communities in faith. I want to end with this. In an orphan culture that has lost contact with fatherhood and mistrusts fatherhood, we have very good news to share. Because the answer to bad fathers is not no fathers, it's good fathers. It's good, good fathers.